What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since the camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics, activism and action.
And there's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on. It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be in a riot, buddy.
I'm escaping to the one place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space.
I was a victim, too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh, my God.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Three Left Show, live from Grand Street Community Arts here in Albany, New York. Ladies, gentlemen, people of non-conforming genders outside the binary. I'm Dan Platt, your host at the Three Left Show. With me in the studio is Colin.
Ably. Try spelling it.
Yes. It's like Able with an A, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. So, I am pleased to come to you. I'm excited for this week's show after 2 weeks of not being able to save the show properly. We're going to do it right this time. I think everything's worked out. We have a serious management staff and we're moving forward. This show is going to move forward. We have set up hosting with servers and website. So now I just have to populate that website and then we'll be online. You can download the show, go to iTunes. I'll have all that done by the week. That's a promise. Believe it. I got a lot on my mind, but let's just take things one step at a time with news and just things that bother us or make us chuckle. anything on your mind at the moment?
No. Well, why don't we jump right into it? Get into the news.
Okay. So let's start super local and then we'll scale up. Last week I went to county legislature meeting and,
those are always fun.
Oh yeah. Especially when they're actually voting on something that will affect people and usually negatively. So a group or some kind of constituency will come out to actually tell them why what they're doing is a bad idea. And unfortunately, like, the vote is still close. So in this case, DA Soares, District Attorney Soares, wanted a registry for thrift shops. So the problem is that you have all of the thrift stores, particularly in Albany, maybe elsewhere, but within the city limits, that are, you know, dealing with stolen goods. You know, some of them are literally just like a place to hold your stuff and keep the heat off. And so DA Soares wanted to, like, you know, as he put it, recover grandma's necklace. It's all about getting back grandma's necklace. Unfortunately, this is kind of government overreach, the kind of regulation that basically brought out all these antique store and coin collector places. Saratoga coin, Ferris coin, like, you know, they came out to basically say this would not so much, it would really hit them hard. It would make their jobs unworkable, mostly because of market forces. They explained that, well, part of the legislation was that any precious metals have to be held for 10 days. So they're like, I can't hold, the price fluctuates day to day. I can't sell at the right time if I have to wait 10 days. And imagine, like, some other type of product where you have to hold it 10 days before you can
sell it
again.
They're still doing, this is happening now.
Hmm?
This was happening at last week's meeting. This week's meeting.
The vote, yeah. And it didn't pass, but by two votes.
By two votes, huh?
Remember, it's majority Democrat, but you have a lot of law and order types. And to me, it was a county-led piece of legislation, but it brings to mind, for mass audience out there, that this is the dichotomy. We're all familiar with Ben Franklin's, you know, if you want security and freedom at the same time, you'll get neither. Similarly, maybe to update it to make it something a little more cogent, you can't have a police state and a welfare state at the same time. You have all these Democrats that want like kind of maintain the welfare state in this in amber. So in that case, they're kind of conservative in that way, because what are you conservative about? But then they're also law and order. They want to protect people, want to protect businesses and grandma's necklace. So, or they're rather susceptible to the emotional argument, like, well, I was robbed and it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. Kind of, you know, privilege. And the... So you really can't have both. You have to kind of choose, and I would like to think that a lot of people would not want a police state.
I would prefer a welfare state myself, yeah.
Yeah, and there's obviously third options, but that's the binary that our government gives us every time. You can't really argue for anything else. Any type of legislation to take us in a different direction is just not considered. Usually it's like, oh, that costs money. Interestingly, you know, they'll cut and for Deus Ex, it was, to me, my interpretation was it's just to have a few more cases closed to kind of like, I came in blind, like I didn't know what was on the docket. I came in to support someone else who just wanted to bring up an issue related to parking in front of DSS, that's the social services office. There was no designated parking there. So you have a lot of handicapped people, poor people who really can't afford parking. It's all metered around there.
On Washington Avenue?
Yeah.
Yeah, that place is a mess.
And there's the social workers whose job it is to ferry people there most of the time.
Yep.
And they could have designated parking, but they also don't. So you almost have like a impromptu pickup and drop off area. But it's like three car spaces. And there kind of needs to be like half the block, which could work since the other half of the block is all designated, like given over to the bus system. So it could, you have a block that's kind of not, no parking on it.
Yeah.
Or some other kind of voucher system. Like that's what she was like saying, like, hey, could you work on this? The health committee, work with the city of Albany. Because it'll be a game of hot potato. County people will say, oh, that's a city problem. They're the ones handing out the tickets. And if you go to the city, it's like, oh, well, that's a county building, and this is a county, you need a county program for it. So you'll have a lot of shirking of responsibility, and the only way anyone does is if it's involving the police state. There's always money for police state. And I think that burns us as leftists, that we can spend millions upon millions, and then when it comes to representing more people, let's say, because it'll be in, the county will, again, consider downsizing the number of seats. It's 49, which
in the
is
county, right, legislature.
Yeah, it's the highest. It's one of the highest in the country at 49.
Yeah, this is also an issue that I hear keeps on coming back.
And it's apparently Higgins, who's, you know, one of these progressive Democrats, that keeps bringing it back. And I'm like, why? And it's like, well, it makes it more things more efficient, and maybe it will eliminate some Republican seats, but. It's more going to eliminate the minority majority seats.
Wasn't Anton Konev one of the people who, when he ran for county legislature as a Republican, I believe,
uh-huh,
years and years ago, before, yeah, he won his common council seat?
Because he's like an independent guy who's a chameleon.
Yeah, well, somebody who obviously believes in representative democracy, right? Who believes in liberal democracy, that you elect representatives.
That's assumed, but it's take it for granted, I, yeah, think. But a lot of liberals are very authoritarian. On a lot of things.
Yeah, I don't think that reducing the size of the legislature is going to do anything. Really, then there's just fewer people that could potentially listen to somebody like your friend who comes to a legislative meeting with an issue to put forward to the legislators.
Their justification is that it saves the county some money because, well, why don't you just cut your pay then?
Yeah.
Cut the pay for all the legislators.
That'll save some money.
Yeah. Instead of cutting seats. But that's not on the table. It's not even part of the discussion.
No.
So I'll bring it up the next time I go to speak out on it because, you know, it's... A group can come and speak out, but like it will be recognized almost as an excuse, but also the reality that this is a vocal minority. The people who really care came up to show up. And let's say the people who care are the loudest, are always against things, or they're against any kind of change.
Right. Well, that's even, everything. That's every yeah, group that goes to a county legislative or a town council meeting.
It's the most conservative.
Or even people who go to the assembly and the Senate.
I'll say that's not always true because I've been part of groups that will speak for something, but that then it usually won't pass.
Yeah, right.
So it just goes that the inertia is always to not change anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, I think that shows the lack of effectiveness of representative liberal democracy is that you can ask and ask and ask, but really you have no power. You get to say
as individuals. Even as a advocacy group, it's mm-hmm. still like, oh, you're just a little bit of people representing a small constituency, not a big voter
yeah,
base.
Yeah, everyone is turned into a small vocal minority, and the only time you get to work as a mass is on one day every year, election day.
Yeah,
It's every other year for most seats. I believe the county legislators have 4-year terms. Am I correct?
Yes.
And they're not up for re-election this year. I know this isn't a local election year. This is a federal.
No.
And gubernatorial election year.
And the competition's always not very fierce.
No.
The
Oh, no. These small legislative district races are...
And it's always a battle of personalities more than policies. In fact, there's rarely any... I look for platform distinctions in the Democratic Party politics here. And maybe this goes for out there, wherever you live, that... The differences will be personality based, just like, oh, I'm just better at managing. It's a battle of resumes.
Yes.
And that's kind of it's the technocratic, meritocratic, and it's not about ideas at all. Ideas are like meaningless.
No.
And it's like, well, no vision, and thus everyone, that's what creates a culture of hopelessness. Like, well, there's nothing to fight for. There isn't even any cultural cachet much anymore.
Furthermore, when you get down to these local elections, you would think that there's a lot of more, that it's more democratic, right? Because you have a smaller constituency.
Yeah.
Assume that. But really, the problem is that all of these little legislative districts all have their own Democratic and Republican committees.
Yeah.
And the people on those committees have just been there for years and years and years, these old guys. And they're the ones who really pick which candidate runs. If you're an outsider, a progressive, you're not going to get in your foot in the door. They're going to say, nope, we've already got our guy. You're not experienced enough. You're not a veteran, so that's not good. We don't like your radical left-wing ideas.
You're not a parent.
You're not a parent. Yeah, if you're not a parent, then how?
I can't. I usually don't run for school board. You know, people say, like, why do you run for mayor? Why do you run for school board first? Like, well, it's the same citywide race. For one, I still have to cover the same amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
It's less competition as far as like there's 3 seats open. I don't need like a plurality of people to support me, just enough. You can vote for multiple people, so it's really just who you actually don't want to be seated, especially if it's like there's 3 seats and there's like 4 candidates or 3, like in the case of our last school board election. But that's kind of the case that certain radical organizers will make, is to go after those smaller seats that don't take a lot of money to run for. And so that's what I'll do next time, at least, now that I've kind of cut my teeth and done outreach. Let's see where to go with that. Another kind of to throw out, that's also pluralist democracy that has these weaknesses. I think it was like a critique of pure tolerance it's not coming to me. I need to review it.
Was it Karl Popper that you can't tolerate the intolerable?
It's not that. It was more like lobbying is done through advocacy groups that are competing with each other, and you're not going to come to any kind of harmony or consensus with that. I mean, it's like, it's interesting that the liberal point of view is that, like, we things work out when we're all struggling and there's conflict, but at the same time they want everyone to compromise. It works out if we just fight hard for what we believe in. But like, what do they believe in? You know, law and order usually, like the maintaining of the capitalist order. You
very,
know,
very general statement.
We're for small businesses. Yep. We want to increase the tax base. That's a favorite locally here. Increase the tax base. What does that mean?
The easiest way to increase the tax base is to increase taxes on the people who can afford to pay them. But
that would be my interpretation.
That's never on the table. It's always you need to
we need
bring
to
in new
grow
businesses.
The pie. Grow the pie, not divide the pie better.
Yes.
You can do both, but we cannot do infinite growth anymore. I mean, it's just not economically, even by market standards, it's not possible
anymore. Yeah, and capitalism needs that infinite growth. It needs the constant movement. If movement stops and if growth stops, the whole system collapses.
So we got to be ready for that. So grow your own food, God, people. Like I'm relearning how to do. And let's see. So we can scale up to the national level. We have concentration camps, and we've had them for a long time, probably yes. since 9/11 really did change everything. Because it basically, the horror starts then. All of the infrastructure, legal or otherwise, was put in place. It's been mentioned that these are like the FEMA camps that conservatives, the right, were afraid of. But really, they're just afraid of them being put in the camps. And anyone else can go into the camps. It's really a matter of a question.
Conservatives are,
you know, who's getting hurt? And the same with liberals. Like, oh, it's not me who's starving or homeless. So yes. I'm going. They consider like people in the way.
Well, so there's two general feelings about this in the body populace, right?
Right.
Number one, you have your conservatives who look at these concentration camps for children of color. And if you go, don't go online and read the comments that some of these people leave, because some of them are like, oh, this is great. Why are they letting them live? They should just shoot them. You know,
I think they have sometimes.
Why don't they put them to work, instead of keeping them in cage?
They have done that for all the railing on
liberals that we do. Conservatives are just absolutely vile people and racist.
That's why we fight them in the street. We punch them.
But the liberals, they're all up in arms now when really this stuff has been going on since the Obama administration. And you didn't hear a peep.
I gotta rail against the quote unquote pragmatism. So in activist scenes or otherwise, and even in corporate media, from the left side, the liberal side, it's always like we need to ask for what's possible. We need to ask for what can be legislated like now, soon, by the people who are there. So you put yourself in a really shallow box, narrow and shallow box, of what you can demand and what you can actually change. So apparently the demand by the liberals, who usually actually get what they want, at least when a deal's made, mm-hmm. then they're satisfied, and thus they shut up and sit down. They're just asking to not separate the families. The families can still be jailed.
Yeah.
They'll still be like, no, opening the borders is that there's another way.
Yeah.
What other way?
Yeah. They're accepting the right wing's framing that these people don't belong here, that they're taking jobs.
That it threatens law and order.
Yes.
To accept them all. And they'll always, and that's why they, the center skews right. Because they accept the right's premises. And mm-hmm. once you do that, you're just changing. It's just a difference of what the conclusion is in terms of based on that empathy value that liberals are like. They're truly just the outraged group that where right-wingers were outraged at everything Obama did. They're outraged. And it's so impotent to me because the best they can get from all this outrage that they have is don't break up the families. Yes. Imprison them together.
Yeah, that'll make them feel better.
But we on the left demand more. #demandmore.
Don't imprison them at all.
Don't, yes.
Give them the asylum that they're seeking because they're escaping situations that imperialism is responsible for to begin with.
So step one could be end the drug war, which they will also oppose.
Right.
And say, oh no, we need to study it for another 10 years. We stop the drug war. We stop the flow of migrants. Close the wound by at least accepting the people now, and then they can actually go back home. A lot of the people don't because the drug war has gone on for our lifetimes and more.
Right.
But the drug war exists to suppress the left at home and abroad.
Yes, and it's an easy issue.
And you need to look at that and study and know that that's the case.
Yeah, it's a very easy issue because you've just
to go somewhere else.
Well, bring it back to the local races. I mean, any local legislator who wants to get up there and run for office and win in a small constituency can just be like, drugs are bad, I'm against them. And then there you've got your disciplined electorate is like, oh, he's against the bad thing.
On the other hand,
I'll vote for him.
On the other hand, DASORS just had like a forum on legalizing pot. It needs to be decriminalization, but at least he's not like, oh, maybe I won't prosecute pot crimes. But recently, I forget why, I was just kind of perusing YouTube because it is my TV now. A video, it was shared unironically, of Elon Musk's presentation for solar roofs, where it's like the roof that looks like a normal roof, but it's a solar roof. It creates power, and it plugs into all his proprietary technology. Or actually, some of it isn't, but it's a lot of it is. And kind of one of the point was just like he was not a good public speaker. He doesn't seem prepared. I mean, he knew his talking points and like didn't seem to need it because he was maybe without a teleprompter. But he wasn't prepared enough to actually speak consistently. Like, you know, he had a lot of ums and ahs and he kind of had to pause and think about what he was going to say next. And he seemed very awkward. And I guess he's just like the awkward geek and everyone's that's charming to, his groupies, his cultists. That ties into what we were chuckling about where Elon Musk, you know, is on, you know, cause he's been engaging in Twitter wars because I guess he's so busy micromanaging everything in his company, he doesn't trust anyone else to do it. But then he also has all this time to tweet and have Twitter wars with journalists and people who cover him. And he says, no, I'm a socialist, but just...
Yeah.
In the way that I was... Actually, the first time I was introduced to socialism was the same way. So it's that really baby level, non-woke, non-lit version of like, if you're going to use socialism in a positive light, but don't have any political philosophy knowledge whatsoever,
or historical knowledge,
right?
About
any of that.
Actually existing socialism,
any of that. So if you're starting from zero, and it's like, oh, socialism, it just means you're pro. It's an ideology of being social, and I want to do things for the greatest number of people. Like, but that's utilitarianism.
Yep.
To be
straight
clear.
Up liberal utilitarianism.
So, but then call that socialism. So that's what Musk did. And then, what else did he say?
Well, he said that Marx was a capitalist because Marx wrote a book about capitalism. Which
Melville was a whale. Kafka was a cockroach.
Stephen King was a clown.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a good one.
Michael Moore was a what was the name of Michael Moore is a stupid white man.
Oh, well, he is in some ways. Rowling, some contend, is a witch.
Tolkien was a hobbit.
Mm,
ate 7 meals a day.
He wanted to be.
Stood 3'2".
Probably did. He ate many meals.
It's just, you know, the problem that this is one of the major misconceptions that people have about Marx is that he didn't describe what socialism should be. He simply described in Das Kapital how capitalism works and in those workings that there are inner contradictions between like the social necessity of labor versus the privatized profits from it that are going to lead to capitalism's downfall and why it needs to be replaced. I mean, he wasn't imagining.
He did write a lot
new world.
Though, about social, what socialism would be. I mean, there's the critique of the GAFA program, right?
Yes.
And he's written a lot more. I'm mostly reacting to what other people were proposing, because that was his thing. And then Capital was his own ideas thrown out there.
Right.
As well as the actual Communist Manifesto, which was him and Engels saying, like, okay, because up until that point, all the social movements had these religious flavor.
Utopian
like,
ideas.
We're just going to be... We're just fighting for justice. We're not going to articulate what that is, but we're just going to like say that we're being exploited. It's kind of what a lot of liberals do. It's like, you know, we'll state a problem, but the solutions will be very, very vague. And the Communist Manifesto was like, no. We should say what we're for. We're for communism.
Yes.
We are communists. We have this identity.
We disdain to conceal our views.
Right. That kind of stuff. So that was really important at the time, and that's what it basically created the sea change of then afterwards movements had that socialist labor character, labor movement character instead.
Well, a more scientific character.
Less spiritual. Before then, most revolutions had a spiritual character, whether it be a peasant revolts were kind of sometimes religiously inspired,
yes,
as like being a new split from the church to have, you know, they had charismatic leaders in that way, and so they had those weaknesses, and they would fail most of the time, but usually because of lack of outside support, you know, no one in the upper classes would take their side. Maybe one would, but then he would get killed, stuff like that. I'm thinking of German revolts and cross Europe and Middle Ages and Renaissance era, stuff like that, because they were always present. Revolts from lower classes. It's just that they usually just didn't win for lack of money and support. The military wouldn't side with them, so on and so on. The state wasn't weak enough. That's a particular point.
Right.
That if you're going to have a revolution or whatever you want a revolution to be, there needs to be a weakness in the establishment. So let's say it's the Bernie-crats. Like, you're not going to create a political revolution and take over the Democratic Party unless they're weak. So,
and they're not.
They're some of their donors, like the small donors, aren't giving money to the Dems anymore. But as far as the individuals are concerned, they're still like, they've still got those, the Tech Valley people and all those other millionaires behind them. In fact, the millionaires are just like, oh, I'm going to run. Because that's what it takes.
Mm-hmm. It just takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of money to run a campaign. And they've got the big donors. They've figured out. I mean, everyone was really inspired by Bernie Sanders' average $27
mm-hmm.
Donated. And that's because he gave a message that is popular with the people, but he failed. He didn't make it. He didn't make it. The system was rigged against him.
Not for lack of popularity.
Not for lack of popularity, but, part of it, I think, is Bernie's own fault. In that he decided that he was going to, from the beginning, support the eventual Democratic nominee. He copped out
that goes
at
into,
the very beginning.
Yeah, yeah. That goes into the topic that we'll probably, I don't know if we'll hit it this show, but we'll spend a good amount of time on that conversation.
Yeah.
So I'm going to transition to a kind of monumental topic here, but also still critiquing our economic system, capitalism overall. We call it that. If you've ever been to a political rally, let's say it's a Poor People's Campaign that's happening right now.
I think they're done. I think they're 40 days
they're
of
done
action.
They're done with the actions, but they're
set.
They're kind of...
Now we see what else comes of it.
They're going... Yeah, maybe like what kind of reaction did they sign up more people, then they can kind of create more working groups and stuff like that. But you went to one. I didn't make any, unfortunately. I kind of wanted to, but then I... They would move from outside to inside the Capitol buildings.
Yeah,
regardless of what state you're in.
I only went outside to see what the scene was like, talk to a couple people, get there. And when I did talk to people, I did get some solid support for an outright anti-capitalist by name.
Yeah.
Stance. I just didn't see any of their leaders in any of their speak outs or any of the live feeds in the video, which I watched from inside the Capitol. None of the language actually said that capitalism itself was the problem. No, none of them. They were all very much tied into the idea that we are a lobbying group and we are going to get people out to vote to effect change. And we're going to just basically lobby our legislators to try and get what we
vote
want.
Vote for Democrats.
Vote for Democrats because
leverage.
Yes.
Apparently.
And try to push the Democrats left. To support social programs for the poor, for people of color, for LGBT. I mean, it was for everybody, for basically every oppressed group's immigrants.
I don't think that's worked in my lifetime.
No, it's not worked in our lifetime.
That's my position. It's what I've observed. I've lobbied and been part of these rallies for a good decade now.
Yeah, and after a while, you start to see the pattern.
Now, I have some observations. Someone on Facebook who was involved in our area was kind of pointing out that there was the separation between leadership as far as ideas and the rank and file.
The people who were there.
As you said, anti-capitalists have a critique, they're left-wingers. And then the leadership are more liberal. I mean, they're the religious leaders. That's the apparently the character of the Poor People's Campaign. Yes. They're trying to recreate what MLK wasn't able to do because he was killed, assassinated by the government. Just general advice, don't try to recreate the past. Create a future. And a future, and to learn off the successes of what has already happened, in my eyes, that, you know, Occupy was leaderless. We didn't have leaders. Everyone was a leader. The rank and file were the leaders. That was the point.
But Occupy got totally bulldozed out of existence after just a couple of months.
Right. Through state oppression. But I do not believe that if we had some leader standing in front as a figurehead to rouse us, I don't think that was going to
would have just given the state an easier target to arrest, right, and imprison, and yes, then yes, your leader. So, then you've got the problem of getting a new leader.
So perhaps your point is that, you know, just having an organization or a movement that is just rank and file is not enough. So and I accept that people step up as leaders at particular times for particular things. It's just a matter of that leadership needs to be delegated. It needs to be chosen, elected.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the case with Poor People's Campaign. This is the active clergy members.
Very top down.
Yes. Like all these other, you know, efforts here. And that's something else to critique. So because like otherwise, like it doesn't look much different than many of the other actions I've gone to during the budget season. That's the, you know, when the legislator is mulling over the budget and making all of its amendments and fighting over what's going to be in it, because most legislation actually has to be completed through the budget, because anything that actually costs money, basically, you can't legislate something separate from the budget. Almost
it all goes into the one big document, and that gets voted up or down.
It's literally called the Big Ugly, and it's hilarious that like everyone considers it that, but no one wants to do anything about it. Apparently everyone's comfortable. They know how that works, how to play that game. They don't want to change the rules, obviously. So I've done a lot of that lobbying and gone to action after action. And the difference in this is that they spent more time so that they could get more people to come. So instead of 30 people, it's 50 people consistently. And they did it for multiple weeks instead of 1 week. But particularly, I mean, as far as like, it would be different causes that would do their week of activism.
Yes.
And then, and that's, so the difference, their new strategy is to just get all of these different poor people's groups to then go at the same time for multiple weeks instead of 1 week at a time.
And highlight one of these issues each week is kind of what they were doing.
Right, which was they're like, okay, we'll, you know, So trying to build some solidarity between these groups to work together in that way, to create some kind of umbrella, a coalition that will last beyond just this budget season. And that's a noble goal, and I think that's the progress they're looking to actually create. It's not really to get the results this session. It's to build that coalition, because that takes time, it's hard work, it's under the radar. But yeah, I mean, how strong is that coalition going to be when there's this rank and file and leadership? Now, maybe the rank and file will delegate their own leadership, and then they'll compete for like who's the spokespeople, because at the moment I don't know what mechanism it's truly like. It's the invisible power dynamic that of like, who's the leader? Why are they the leader? If no one in an organization supports them, why are they still the leader?
Right.
You know, what force, what coercion is being exerted? Is it monetary? Like, everyone in the organization's salaries, you know, their livelihoods depend on them following the leader. Is it, it's certainly not police power, is it? I mean, if you take over the organization, you're committing an illegal act, and so the police can be called in by the leader, the leadership who doesn't represent the rank and file. It'd be nice if, you know, business unionism, that was the case. Meaning supplant leadership, and because I think that's legal. But for that, you need to organize the rank and file and actually get them all in a room to say, like, oh, yeah, we're not being represented well. Because otherwise, the only time they're all in the same place is that rally where the leadership is then talking to them and saying, this is what our organization is about. And then as individuals, we're like, oh, but that's not what I'm about. Maybe I don't belong here. So then everyone leaves, but then they're not talking to each other to say, oh, we all agree on why we're leaving. And that happens time and time again. So that's kind of, that's really interesting to me. Yeah. And it kind of points to, if you're in a movement, make sure that you are having social events or your own meetings with your fellow members that doesn't involve leadership. And that's kind of, you do that with working groups, committees, whatnot. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I agree that being in an organization is important, and doing activism is also important, but almost more important is building the organizational bonds, the interpersonal bonds. That's why my party, the Socialist Party, does things like beer night, mm-hmm. Coffee yeah. with comrades. We're talking about getting a picnic going.
Mm. No, it's summertime.
It's summertime, and you know, and also we're just kind of there for one comrade just lost her mother, and I was like, you know, do you need any food tonight? You know, can you, you know,
I'll make
it. She couldn't make it to the rally that we were going to, the Capitol area against mass incarceration.
What was that for?
That was an anti mass incarceration protest down at the courthouse on Lodge Street.
Actually local Albany.
Local in Albany, yes. And well, it wasn't just local in Albany. It was
because there were also actions.
It was across New York State, yeah. Binghamton, Buffalo, oh, okay. New York City, Suffolk County.
Kind of continuation of Black Lives Matter.
Yes, the speaker there was in a Black Lives Matter shirt. It was an excellent educational opportunity. They had speakers who had been from the prison system, you know, who had been inmates and were speaking out against how violations of rights, especially against women.
I'll point out that here, the mass incarceration group, CAMI,
yes,
is the kind of Black Lives Matter group at the same time.
Okay.
At least they were the same people. So I don't know if Black Lives Matter transitioned into CAMI. I think they were just, but CAMI's also kind of almost a coalition between a few other people with their own causes
mm-hmm.
that all have to do with prison reform. Yes. There's also an action regarding the ICE camps. At least, like, as far as
a the weekly left action, having... Right? Down at the Leo O'Brien yeah. Federal Building. Yes, that's happening Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm. Oh, every Wednesday.
And every Wednesday,
the
yes.
The left is having some, I'm seeing some effect in that our position is to abolish ICE, in part. Right? Mm-hmm. Not, I mean, open the borders, yeah, but let's at least, you know, get rid of the Gestapo.
Get rid of the, yes.
And
this is basically what they are.
Yeah, and I call them that. I call them like the stormtrooping Gestapo of America. I call them that in like a debate.
Yes,
when the Sanctuary City question came up.
It's American fascism.
I said, like, we need to work on actually keeping out ICE because it was at a libertarian-ish conference. Well, it was a civil rights conference, a civil liberty conference, that there was some activists there that were like, their entire work was around resisting ICE. And this was in 2012 and whatever.
And it wasn't getting a lot of attention because we had a Democrat.
It was a
completely
new issue to me. I never heard of ICE before.
Yes, ICE was ICE.
Never heard of them.
ICE,
I'm like, wait,
new.
What's ICE? I'm like, ICE are the people who are this. They're the government agency that are basically terrorizing our communities.
Yeah, I read an article that this all started. It got started under Bush, under the auspices of Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah,
but Obama increased it like 3,000% in terms of funding and boots on the ground, and we didn't. This makes me so angry. I want to pound the table, but I know it would make untoward noises. This is what upsets me about the liberals who are all up in arms about it now. They are only upset and hearing about this because of some boogeyman figurehead racist in the White House. When it was Obama, when it was their guy, totally quiet.
And not to, because I've heard this in many other conversations, left-leaning and otherwise, that like Jimmy Dore show, whatever, that I'll point out that the information was there. The stories were published in The Guardian or whatever.
But the liberal media wasn't pushing it.
Yeah, it wasn't a top story on MSNBC. This is like the difference between what you're... To recognize what outrages you is what is put in front of you.
Yes.
And if you're a Fox News viewer, what outrages you is what's put in front of you. So if you watch Fox News for enough and just that, you will turn into, you know, the picture of that.
This is why.
And if you watch MSNBC, you'll be outraged at Trump because he's in league with Putin and everything he does is on the direct line, which is
he's unpresidential.
It's not false. You know, he is on the phone with Putin because they're friends. You know, I'm like, but I don't, like, is it red baiting? Because, like, oh, because Russia is a communist plot. You know, like, what? How is it corrupting America any more than billionaires funding our elections? How is it more, you know, how is it worse? How is this beyond the pale? How is this the outrage? So, and that's the question the left puts forward, and we usually don't get a cohesive answer. The answer we usually get is you're part of the problem then, because you're against cleaning up the country by getting rid of Trump, who have that impeachment narrative in their heads.
Oh, I mean, my position on Trump is that, you know, something really bad has to happen to him. You know what I mean? He needs to drop dead. He needs to drop dead.
Did Pence just have a heart attack?
By some miracle. I don't know.
Krauthammer just died.
You know. Who?
I need to confirm this, but Krauthammer just died.
Krauthammer. Okay. Yeah. The talking head?
Yeah, one of them.
Oh. Well, I mean.
He'll be replaced.
He's not the worst.
But he'll be replaced.
You know.
There's some young ones in the wings because they're gonna get paid big bucks. You know, there's Turning Point America people. The Dave Rubens, he agrees with that.
Oh no, you know, I think ending it on, you know, we'll hate on the liberals and critique them a lot, but I think it needs to be said, Trump dropped dead.
So next is, we're gonna shift to environmental kind of theme. So usually our conclusion, our message is usually the same. We're kind of repetitious with that, but how we get there can vary. And that's kind of where a lot of my segments are kind of getting at. So this is a story from Grist. That's the name of the mag. And it's about how, in this piece by David Roberts, titled "None of the World's Top Industries Would Be Profitable If They Paid for the Natural Capital They Use."
Yes.
So usually conversations about sustainability, being green, green capitalism, you know, that we can have some kind of, we can still protect the environment, conserve, and not, and still have market economy, still have infinite growth via, you know, profit making banks. And
yeah, infinite growth just gets me reeling. I mean, there's no example of anything in the natural world or the universe that just grows and grows and grows and continues growing.
So even that aside, to look at it from the, does the business sector, does our capital economy even out in any kind of economic sense? I'm getting it. Even if all the economy, there was no monopolies, no oligarchies, it was all small businesses, they would still, their profitability would still depend on all of these free resources. Now, usually, from Marx's point of view, we'll talk about how the free resource is like part of the labor, that they're stealing some of the value of the labor by paying workers less than what they could be.
Variable capital versus fixed capital.
So those are the terms for that. Then there's the free resources, the natural world itself.
Yes.
That they obtain or own or are able to extract from purely because the state that, you know, is funded by them says so. Says you can extract here, and that's it. And there's no compensation needed. What would the compensation even be for? Because the piece kind of begins by kind of going on, kind of going about how to make corporations pay for the environmental costs when we talk about what's called externalities. Pollution, the costs. Let's see. For instance, industrial processes can put pollutants in the air that increase public health costs. But the public, not the polluting businesses, pick up the tab. In this way, businesses privatize profits and publicize costs.
Yes, that's from the article.
Now, this is a theme that comes up when talking about bailouts, particularly, like, you know, after the crash, But it's a constant when it comes to environmental costs.
Yes, things like water.
Main
air.
Example: oil spill.
Oil spill.
There's an oil spill, and it's the National Guard and the government that's cleaning it up.
Not the business.
And I think it will be progressives or Democrats that try to get the corporation to pay for it, and they'll usually maybe get half the cost.
A fraction.
Yeah, not enough, not the whole thing.
Something that just makes them look good. Like, oh, look, we made these bad corporations pay.
Maybe the initial cleanup, but then there's all the cleanup for the decades afterwards. And then there's all the damage to local communities. That doesn't get compensated. So that's usually considered like the natural costs of business as usual. But there's the even deeper thing. Let's see. While the notion is incredibly useful, especially in folding ecological concerns into economics, I've always had my reservations about it. Environmentalists these days love speaking in the language of economics. It makes them sound serious. But I worry that wrapping this notion in a bloodless technical term tends to have a narcotizing effect, a narcotic effect. It brings to mind incrementalism, boost a few taxes here, tighten a regulation there, and the industrial juggernaut can keep right on chugging. However, if we take the idea seriously, not just as an accounting phenomenon, but as a deep description of our current practice, its implications are positively revolutionary. They talk about a report by a consultancy, environmental consultancy called True Cost, on behalf of the Economics and Ecosystems and Biodiversity Program, which is sponsored by United Nations, also known as TEEP. So they wanted to total up the unpriced natural capital consumed by the world's top industrial sectors. Natural capital refused to the ecological materials and services like, say, clean water or a stable atmosphere. Unpriced means that businesses don't pay to consume them, to use them as the base of everything they do. It's a huge task. Obviously, doing it required a specific methodology that built in a series of assumptions, but it serves as an important signpost pointing the way to the truth about externalities. Here's how the costs break down. A majority of unpriced national capital costs are from greenhouse gas emissions, about 40%, followed by water use, a quarter, land use, another quarter, air pollution was 7%, and land and water pollution, 5%, and waste. So even the talk about, like, will be sustainable if we're just not putting in air and land pollution, like landfills and air pollution. That's just 5% of the actual, like, what the damage to nature or the use of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Iceberg. First, the total unpriced natural, let's see, then it goes into numbers. Oh, yeah, explains they split up the world into sectors, regions, such as Eastern Asia, South America, so on, North America. So here are the biggest environmental impacts by region. Coal burning is at the top.
For electricity.
Yeah, coal. Land use via cattle ranching.
South America?
Yes. So all that beef, it's half the rainforest is gone. And they're not just cutting and logging the wood, they are burning it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all that carbon is being put right into the air, and it's not even being logged and used for wood products or something.
No, they're just
because
clearing the land for cattle.
Just clearing the land for that. And that's so the rest of the world can eat beef like Americans. It's truly
constantly.
It was
hamburgers every day.
It was the it's actually the plot of Dead Rising, the video game from 2005, where it's a zombie game. And the zombies are created by trying to increase cattle output by zombifying cattle.
Oh, boy.
And it makes us all zombies in some way. Let's see.
Yeah, I don't mind a good burger, but burgers all the time, you know.
I limit myself to one per year, and then I have to actually think about how good it's going to be, where do I get it from, that kind of stuff. And I think last year, I didn't even have one.
Or steak. The rich love eating steak.
I actually don't like steak.
That's like the once a year treat that I'll.
Yeah, and that's probably, if you're going to still be an omnivore, yeah. If Dave was here, he would make the vegan argument like, we don't need to eat meat, period. So I'll talk for him. So, okay, so let's go with those. Okay, last few bit here. So TrueCross, third big finding.
Coup de grace.
Coup de grace. Why? Oh my God. 3 years of French, and I'm like, total noob at it. Of the top 20 region sectors ranked by environmental impacts, none would be profitable if environmental costs were fully integrated.
Yes, they wouldn't make any money.
Think about that. None of the world's top industrial sectors would be profitable if they could. They had to pay for their full freight. Zero of them. That amounts to a global industrial system built on a sleight of hand. As Paul Harkin likes to put it, we are stealing from the future, selling it in the present, and calling it GDP.
Mm-hmm.
This gets back to what I was saying at the top. The notion of externalities, quote unquote, is so technical, such an economist term. Got a few unfortunate side effects? So just move some numbers from column A to column B, right? But this UN report makes it clear, because believe it or not, I like a little bit of global governance, at least when it comes to the UN actually studying global issues like this.
Yes, that's a positive thing.
Giving us information. But the UN report makes clear that what's going on today is more than just a few accounting oversights here and there. The distance between today's industrial systems and a truly sustainable industrial system. Systems that do not, and this is like that argument for the primitivists that like we can't even have an industrial system at all. Systems that do not spend down stored natural capital, but instead integrate into current energy and material flows, that's like using stuff, is not one of degree, but one of kind. What's needed is not just better accounting, but a new global industrial system, a new way of providing for human well-being, and fast. That means a revolution.
That means revolution, yeah.
That means revolution.
I don't buy the primitivist idea that it's industrialization that has to go.
We could have a socialist one that integrates the costs in a way, because the costs only don't work in capitalism because there needs to be a profit making. Because anything that, like, to fund your business to start extracting from the environment, you're only loaned that money based on the fact that you will make more than what you were given.
Yes.
But you can only do that by extracting resources for free, whether it be natural or human.
Right. So if we had a socialist system where all of these natural resources were owned in common, anybody who wanted to start a business venture, which would still happen, I believe, would have to go to the people and say, I need to use this resource. I'm going to pay for it. And then the cost of business would be offset.
And it certainly can't be done in the current system. Like, you try to be actually sustainable, it just, you have to cut some kind of corner.
You are going to be outcompeted by the people who are extracting resources for free.
Yeah. And that's,
this is what Marx called the coercive laws of competition. If you're not adhering to those laws, you're going to be outcompeted. You can't be the nice capitalist who does everything in a sustainable way. Somebody else out there is going to be in the same line of business, doing things for free, paying their workers less. And then they're going to charge less for their commodity. And the consumer, who is strapped for cash because of the wage labor system, is going to have no choice but to purchase the same commodity at a lower price.
So I'm going to wrap up this conversation, because we'll hit our hour break, with, you know, what makes the right, let's say the Ben Shapiro's and whatever, right-wing talking heads, take your pick, what makes them sound kind of reasonable is, as opposed to our what we're putting out, is they have the base assumption, coined as capitalist realism, that capitalism is the natural state of things. Like, this is how things work. So, you know, it from there flows, like, so that whole, like, because the good actor who wants to help workers, who wants to protect the environment, they'll be outcompeted in the marketplace, which leads to that Ayn Rand philosophy of, well, if that's the case, then you might as well be very selfish. Then we build up a case to be selfish, yeah, to be the cutthroat corporate overlord. Then that's what leads to all those talking heads and their lack of empathy for everything, because it comes from this, their real world belief, you know, they're, I'm just being realistic, and that this is how things work. It's the way things have always worked. It's the way things will always work, which is like saying segregation yesterday, segregation now, segregation forever.
Yeah, capitalism is the way of the world now, but it's one in a series of economic systems that continually progresses.
And our position is that capitalism has been around for a few centuries, but it cannot, we should not, like, we should be moving beyond it. It can't last. We're hurting. I mean, you watch a video of an orangutan protecting its home from palm tree expansion. And, you know, they'll say, it breaks your heart. Why? And so, because human nature is plastic, and it yearns for a system that isn't doing this, that can provide for us and comfort and security and not destroy everything.
Around. Always lost, not found, but I didn't realize. Like a giant standing in my way, leading me astray. Now it's time for me to rise. I knew I had to find myself. Turns out I'm on my own.
Back at the Three Left show for radical left-wing politics here in Albany, New York, broadcasting from our community radio station Hub, a community effort under a nonprofit label, but otherwise here and independent. Independent media is what we need. It's what we are. How are you doing, Colin?
I'm doing well. Nobody's paying me to be here. It feels great.
Neither am I. I'm so excited. I mean, this is, I'm really, not just hoping, but I'm assured that this will be like the light of my week. The thing that I look forward to, because I have to work the rest of the day. And,
I just want to note that I will not be here next week because there's going to be a lot of protests around the country on June 30th. And I believe I last read in about 130 cities, there's going to be protests against the immigration situation.
I think there's going to be this big right-wing rally in DC, and so they'll probably be want to have a good big counter to that.
Yeah. Oh, is that happening?
And it has a specific white supremacist character, a kind of take back our country.
So is there going to be a big right-wing protest on the same day there's big protests to against the immigration policy?
Probably. I mean, it's about that. It's interesting that almost with all the news about the ICE camps and whatnot, that it's only in certain podcasts, I think Chapo mentions it, maybe Jimmy Dore is mentioning it, that, and it's otherwise I wouldn't be really aware that this is like, that's what's in front of the Congress right now, to rehash for the third time this century immigration reform that, you know, wasn't done the last two times.
Yeah, no one wants to touch this stuff.
Why? Because
Right wing gets super angry about it.
Well, there's the populist kind of side, which just wants to protect, you know, what the white supremacy. But then there's the corporate side that doesn't care about their white identities
yeah.
so much, but but just the profits they make from the cheap labor,
cheap
of
immigrant
immigration.
Labor, man.
And the migration itself is then caused by the globalization of putting factories in Mexico for cheap labor there, which then disrupted communities. It destroyed farming, like whole, like imagine a county. And then, I mean, this happened here in Albany County. We used to have pig farms and all kinds of farming and different kinds of agriculture, meat production. And it's all been consolidated in the South. It's all been destroyed up here. Like, we just don't have any of it. I mean, we have some farms here and there, but it's hardly a sector, and it's like 1% of our economy. It's nothing.
Yeah.
But all of these farms, and any farm that is kind of like big enough to actually be a producer of some kind, like the apple farms, guess who does a majority of the picking?
Oh,
migrant labor.
Yeah,
I worked at unprotected. They don't even have legal protection of bathroom breaks.
Yes, I worked at Indian Ladder Farms in Altamont Voorheesville for a little bit. Yeah,
I knew someone who works at another apple farm or worked. I don't know if he still do. Oh, that's right.
The pickers were Jamaican.
Yeah, it's a good pay, but you basically work all day.
Yes, I've never seen
people
work harder.
What stops me is I don't have a car and I don't want to drive up to Saratoga or something. But it was on the table. I mean, like, the one guy I was working with pointed it out and he was like, oh, it's good money. And he's a workaholic though. So it's like, there's a difference between.
Oh, it's, you kind of have to be under this system, a workaholic to, and if you can't work all the time and you can't be constantly selling your time to a boss for pay,
if you're not in shape,
you're going to start sinking under the cracks. I mean,
you'll last a week.
Yeah.
So that's why it's like, oh, us Americans, we're so soft, and yet the people are complaining. I mean, I suppose the people that are most protective of their gerbs from migrants are like the trades, the guys who are in the field kind of doing manual labor, which is interesting in that respect. I mean, if you have an office job, you don't feel like you're going to be replaced by a migrant, at least an immigrant to America. You'll be replaced with someone in India. Or China, because it's you know, it could be done by telecommuting.
Yep, or somebody younger, someone who'll work for less wages because they haven't been around, they don't have the seniority.
Yeah, and since, you know, I don't even know if I'm refusing to do that, because my general position on, as far as like when I look for a job, it's so I do political activism. It is. You can't separate it from my resume. If I took everything that was in, like, volunteer work or political out, I would be left with something that made me look like I was still a teenager. Like, I'd only worked a few, like, spare jobs and some warehouse thing. And I wouldn't look like I'd done anything. But obviously, I've done a lot with my life. I have a lot of different skills. I gained them in ways that I wasn't being paid. And that's... It sucks because, as far as the city's concerned, they only accept experience if you were paid to do it.
Yeah, if you're not making money out of something, it's totally worthless. This is one thing. So for me, I have this hobby. I like tending bar. Mm-hmm. I like making cocktails. Mm-hmm. And all the time, I'll get comments like, "Oh, this is really good. Why aren't you a bartender?" And it's like,
they won't hire me because I haven't worked at a bar.
Well, I have worked at a bar, and yeah, I can tell you, it is hard work. You are on your feet. You are taking orders really fast. You are up late. And for someone with my condition, you can't be working that kind of stress in that kind of hours. And also, the drinks you make, you don't have time to make a really good one. Mm-hmm. You have to do it like McFood style.
It's not fun.
It's not fun, but you're making money out of it. So, no, it's much, much nicer.
These things do have an inverse relationship.
Yeah.
But if you want to enjoy life, it basically means like you should make less money in some way. And that's kind of the tack I take, as well as, so what I was going with is, you know, I've been told by family members and other people in the right that it hurts my chances of being hired that I'm political.
Yes.
I can create controversy. I may not work well with management or whatever. And even though I say like, oh, look, you know, I do need to eat and I will follow orders. Especially since I'm applying to a place where I know that whatever I can expect that any order I'm given will be something I can carry out ethically. But that doesn't matter.
No, you can't put...
Hurts my chances. But then I'm like, I get out. My sense of indignation and outrage at the world is then like, well, if being political, speaking my mind, working on what I care about, means I can't have these jobs, then I don't want these jobs, because it's basically saying I need to shut up and follow and not be who I am.
Yes, you need to be a good little worker bee. You can't. It's this is a huge contradiction, right? We are taught growing up that in America,
express yourself.
You have this wonderful, hard fought won
right
to express yourself and be active politically. But when you grow up, you know, if you go into a job interview and you actually say, "Oh yes, I'm politically active," they're going to look at you and be, "Oh,
wear a shirt with a message on it."
This guy is going to be a troublemaker, right? This guy is going to, when he sees problems in the organization, he's going to say something about it. And that's going
to
hurt
others.
Our productivity.
He's not going to talk about sports.
Oh my God, he might start a union. Yeah, it's detrimental.
Fired immediately.
Yeah, I found that out very quickly in my early days of employment. I mean, I kept on losing jobs for other reasons, for mental health reasons. Mm-hmm. But I certainly was doing myself no favors putting on that I worked for, you know, a failed state Senate campaign or a failed Democratic primary, that my political blog got a lot of hits on Daily Coast and the Albany Project back when that was still around.
You'd think if it's some kind of media company that they would like that.
Yeah.
But maybe, that's not our politics or something of that nature.
No.
So, but it's because, you know, it's the marketplace that kind of allows that, and it's market economics. So that's kind of my sense of, like, I don't like markets to make it personal. It's like, because it limits the kinds of opportunities I have,
mm-hmm.
it basically allows people to shut the door in my face, and basically I can't make a living. And
now I will say,
I haven't tried rabble rousing in my current job yet.
Well, let's be clear also,
but they didn't care when I was campaigning outside of work.
No. So. And they also wouldn't care if you put on your resume that you were president of the college Republicans. You know, let's be very clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
businesses
sure.
like it when you have right-wing and conservative credentials.
When you're, because that means you're.
If you're a leftist at all, even if you're like doing Democratic Party stuff, you know that counts for left in this completely messed up political spectrum that we have in America.
Right.
That would hurt your chances too.
It wouldn't hurt your chances though if it was an organization or company that is affiliated with the Democrats in some way, though.
That's very
so.
Possible.
Then at least you're playing into that faction,
but
of
you
the
still have
class.
To. You still have to pick one of the two capitalist establishment parties,
and choose wisely when it comes to like what companies that you're.
Yeah, if I was to put on my working resume, if I was to decide that I need to get work, like if I lost my disability benefits and had to go back into the workplace, if I put on my resume that I was chair of
you
the Capital District Socialist Party, forget it. They would be like, Socialist Party. You really are loony, you know.
And like I said, I'm tempted to remove any kind of like the political campaigns I could probably take off my resume and other things like that.
You've run for mayor and county executive before a couple
times. But let's say it's not the even party stuff. Take that off. Take out these kind of things that are more explicit. I would be left with very little because I've done very little else in my life. As far as career building and whatever, because I wasn't able to. The recession stomped on that.
Yes.
Like, if the recession had come a few years later, or even earlier, perhaps, then the trajectory of my life would have taken a very different turn.
Yes.
I probably would have some kind of career. Now, maybe I'd still have some kind of activism, maybe. But it would be more in my spare time. I wouldn't have devoted so much time to it.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier in the show.
Dig deep into consensus and occupy stuff.
You mentioned earlier in the show that 9/11 changed everything, right? That's the conventional wisdom. Really what changed everything in the 21st century is the crash of 2008 that we still haven't recovered from. And that, the super wealthy have certainly recovered from it.
The crisis is every day, though, for all of us.
The crisis is every day for the working class and even the middle class now. And I don't remember when I read it, but I did see an article popping up here and popping up elsewhere that posits that there's going to be another one of these crashes in not too long of time. probably at some point during Trump's first term, there's going to be another financial crisis.
I hope, dear listener, that you don't think we're being pompous by like being so predictive, but we are vague enough to like not put a year on it. We're just going to say, well, just based on the history that we have a crash or some kind of recession
about every 10 years, 10, 12 years, 15 if things are going really well.
Right. If it's a really good boom time, then it's 15 and maybe 18 years. But that's literally like American history is these punctuated by these recessions. And then when things recover, then it's the boom times again.
Yeah.
Usually when some new resource has been found and we have growing new industries. So in this case, it's tech.
Or after a big war and we are the victors.
Yeah, and in which case we're extracting more from others. That's not wealth that was created in America because we couldn't. That's what caused the recession, that we hit a limit on how much wealth could be created. So thus, we had to expand somehow. And I guess that's why it's the only way that makes, you know, Trump saying, we should have a space force. It makes sense as far as we've hit a wall on Earth, so we have to go to space to extract resources.
I mean, this is Trump's real, like, Reagan moment, right? Because it was Ronald Reagan who wanted to start the Star Wars program. And everyone, like, nobody took it seriously. Everyone made a joke out of it. This is pretty much the same. Like, we have made no progress, right? Since when we were little kids in the 1980s, we once again have a totally underqualified, rambling actor, basically celebrity president, and now he wants to go to space.
Reagan at least was an actor, and Trump, I guess he, I mean, his life is a whole act. So
yeah,
so that there's a difference there. But I am also puzzled by like the people who live through all that and they think Trump is new. I mean, yes, it's worse, but that's only because of their lifetime of putting up with worse,
mm-hmm.
the lesser evil. But as far as the concept of, well, Reagan was an actor who didn't have any substance, but made people feel good, feel like the economy was doing well. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. That's why we had all the cyberpunk then. All of the movies were about apocalypse.
Yes.
Bad futures. And when we haven't, Hollywood still can't seem to, I can name on one hand the number of sci-fi films that have a positive future kind of thing going on. But usually, like, what makes the plot happen is something terrible that, you know, isn't very utopian at all. And I'm thinking of Star Trek's plots.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather, the... very few Star Trek plots are just about what's happening on Earth. And I would really like a show like that. Or maybe a colony. You know, that's where I wish Star Trek went. Just make it about one colony. Kind of like Deep Space Nine, but all Federation. And what kind of problems do they even have, you know? We're going to turn back to our environmental kind of, we call it, theming, I suppose. Sorry, as we critique our system and discuss what we can do differently. And I guess we will... So this story here is from EcoWatch, written by the Natural Resources Defense Council, a large nonprofit organization, I guess, one of them. And so am I a hypocrite for like saying, oh, nonprofits, they're, you know, funded by... the rich, and that's where they have to get their money. That doesn't mean they don't do good work, but and I use it when it's there. So, but just to recognize that. Biomass more polluting than coal, new study finds. This is published 2017. Biomass is the burning of... So if you remember...
Like wood burning.
Yeah, you wouldn't think of... long time ago, and I'm only reminded of it because I have a Lewis Black album and from 06 or something, and he talks about the recently passed energy bill that he joked about was meaningless. And it wasn't, though. It just wasn't publicized what it was actually doing. In the corporate media, I think it was like you had Bush talking about switchgrass and growing... Well, basically, you have biofuel, the ethanol from corn,
yep.
this switchgrass. You grow all of this plant stuff that has a certain carbon that's carbon rich, and then you basically process that and create gasoline or something like it out of it. And you can make biofuel to run a car and whatnot from grease and sunflower, pressing sunflower seeds and whatever. And biomass, yes, is like kind of the waste products of various industries that use natural resources, as we were talking about, for free. And then using the waste to at least not be wasteful by using that, by kind of making it, by processing it in different ways and make it burnable or just to throw it into incinerators for energy. So this is written by Sami Yasa. A preeminent think tank in UK, Chatham House, issued a seminal report last week challenging a fundamental assumption underlying European renewable energy policy. The burning forest biomass to produce electricity is carbon neutral. The report, Witty Biomass for Power and Heat, Impacts on Global Climate, finds that many forms of forest-driven biopower are likely increasing carbon pollution rather than reducing emissions, and calls for restrictions on existing government incentives for the biomass industry in the EU. I think sometimes the right wing will like talk about, sometimes it's like one of those like clocks being broken, clock being right twice a day. They'll say that environmentalists do more harm than good, but maybe they're just talking about the economy. The context of this analysis is a cross-Atlantic dirty energy boom fueled by misplaced subsidies, that energy bill from the aughts, intended to promote clean energy. Currently, energy companies, and also the deregulating of energy companies allowing for fracking and whatnot.
Yes.
That was the other big part of the energy bill in the aughts that was going to, and it did keep gas prices low. So I guess mission accomplished as far as that's concerned. But what we wanted was renewable energy. These exports are driven by generous EU renewable energy subsidies that erroneously reward all forest biomass as carbon neutral, equivalent to non-polluting sources like solar and wind. In other words, when counting carbon pollution at a biomass power plant, EU regulators treat the discharge from the smokestack as zero carbon, even though biomass combustion releases carbon emissions.
Yeah. Where there's smoke, there's fire.
Or there's fire, there's smoke. The report provides exhaustive research and deliberative reasoning to debunk the industry-promoted myths, because it is an industry for profit, financed by banks. But I mean, they're also subsidized by the state, so it's like another way of free, of not actually paying for what you're doing. Biomass plants pollute at the smokestack at levels comparable to fossil fuels. Since wood has a lower energy content compared with fossil fuels while also having a higher moisture content, its combustion for energy usually emits more carbon per unit. So we're just talking about carbon here, not like toxic fumes, you know, like if there's no mercury in it or whatever, but we're just talking about carbon and putting that into the atmosphere. Burning biomass produces a carbon debt, which is not automatically offset by forest regrowth. The report goes on to underscore a fundamental flaw underlying the arguments of biomass proponents, namely that since forests can regenerate over time, sequester carbon, that it's offsetting it. The report rejects that overly simplistic error, as we should about many claims of industry.
That's right.
Anything for profit really should be taken critical as like, raise your eyebrow, like they're leaving something out, always. Even if they don't mean to. In sum, it confirms the findings of many prior scientific inquiries that not all biomass is created equal, and burning whole trees in particular is always detrimental to climate. The harvesting of whole trees for energy will, in almost all circumstances, increase net carbon emissions very substantially. While wood pellet manufacturers in the U.S. Southeast claim that most of their wood pellets are produced with residues, the report shows that about three-quarters of the pellets from the southern U.S. came from whole trees, and residues accounted for a quarter. There's also the time scale. It takes longer for forestry to grow than it takes to burn it.
Yep.
Sustainable forestry does not mean carbon neutrality. Many biomass proponents like to argue that biomass fuel sources sourced from a region where the net forest growth is positive or where sustainable forestry is practiced is carbon neutral. Such logic is nonsense. Rates of forest growth simply cannot detect quantity or reflect the carbon emissions from an individual biomass burning facility. basically you cannot actually measure to say it's neutral. So it's just a matter of the claim doesn't have, you can't measure it, so there's no evidence. Or rather, analyze it anyway. Among the report's many recommendations, three stand out as rejecting the fundamental carbon neutral assumption. It is not valid to claim that because trees absorb carbon as they grow, the emissions from burning them can be ignored. The provision of financial and regulatory support, being very wordy here, limited only those feedstocks, that meaning what you put into the power plants. In practice, this means that support should be restricted to sawmill residues together. That's sawdust.
Just sawdust.
Together with post-consumer waste, like wood chips and whatever. Burning slower decaying forest residues or whole trees means that carbon emissions stay higher for decades than if fossil fuels had been used. Burning forest biomass is not a climate solution. It often worsens climate change because you're actually taking away carbon sinks. So that's the conclusion. It has the opposite effect. Much like many of these green capitalism, we can have new industries replace the old industries and they'll be green.
Just sounds good, and it actually really doesn't change the underlying economic system.
That's what it needs. Yeah, that's what we're about. And then we discussed, you know, we already discussed tactics of how, you know, what's effective in protesting and organizing. So we did discuss what to do about it. And then the program then is to when you think ecologically, it just comes down to having a lot of permaculture, to building infrastructure like wind and solar that is eventually doesn't need rare earth metals. There are many ways of doing this, or at least not on a mass scale, but there have been investigations. There are some products like this thing called the Humdinger, which is like a vibrating belt. Like, so you have this piece of cloth. You know how like if you kind of stretch it out in the wind, it vibrates?
Yes.
And so if you attach like some magnets to one end of it, you're creating an electronic current from just that, the vibrating of that piece of fabric in the wind. So you stretch that out to a meter, and then you basically have 30 of these arrays. 30 of the one pieces of fabric. Then that's enough to power cows. Or a few appliances. But then it's about, like, you know, living simply, how much electronics do you need on at once?
Yeah.
Having buildings and housing that lets more natural light in so that you only need light at night.
That's basically how I live, you know?
It's a small-scale wind generator, because otherwise a lot of turbines are really inefficient. It's a lot of weight, you know, it takes a lot of wind to push it. There are experiments with like paper turbines or turbines that are made of lighter materials, and this was one of them. I researched it in school. It was a group that was operating in Haiti. Where are we in time? Okay. So, if you mentioned mental health, your mental health getting in the way of being employed. And I have, I'm just going to quickly hit, I'm not going to go through all of this, so maybe we'll revisit it at another time.
Okay.
It's an article that my autistic roommate Isaac shared with me, Mad in America, Science, Psychiatry, and Social Justice. That's the name of the publication. And it's...
This is a whole magazine or something?
Yeah. It's a whole website here.
Called Mad in America?
Mad in America. Okay, so here's a perspective we usually don't hear about. When we're talking about mental health in America, mental health care, we're rarely listening. The voices put on TV and whatever, they're rarely the mentally ill themselves.
Yeah.
I think we could recognize that.
Very rare.
It's
usually mental health experts.
It sets up a wall that they can't speak for themselves. They're all like children. They are not competent. But really, if the system says you're not competent, it usually means you're not competent to work a 9-to-5 job, right?
Right.
But not do a lot of other things like speak for yourself, right? It's just a matter of how much time they can devote to it or do it effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But they can still do it. So they can speak for themselves, and this would be one of those platforms, because the internet allows such platforms to even exist, where they can, so I'm going to share that. The piece is called How Do We Know If We Overthrew the Mental Health System? By Au Valencia, published in March of this year. And the main kind of thesis is to transform or reform the mental health system is pretty much to abolish it as it is. And this is because at its very heart, it is coercive. It's like, take these pills or you'll be imprisoned kind of thing. There's really not a lot of choice to it.
Yeah.
And that choice sounds... of treatment as well as, you know, other things. And media portrayals do not help with this. Sometimes it's takes a bit, but the radicalness of the anti-psychiatry. So this is usually, when you hear anti-psychiatry, maybe your mind shifts to the Scientology or just crazies who want to be crazy. But this is, of course, is ableist language. To use words like idiot, crazy, dumb, is to just call someone mentally ill. And basically, it's an ad hominem.
Yes.
That's not based on any actual criticism. Like, if they're speaking ignorantly, say they're ignorant. If what they're saying is problematic or just has issues with it, you know, it's like, oh, that's gross. You know, like, use other... There's so many other qualifiers. And that's another kind of topic to... I have another article on that, of words to use instead of idiot, dumb, stupid, which are all words created to describe people with Down syndrome and schizophrenia. And it basically hurts all those people who are diagnosed with that, who are getting supposedly treatment.
Yeah.
And
crazy and insane are the ones that really get me.
It dehumanizes those with how are we going to help the mentally ill if you're basically synonym for bad is mentally ill?
Yes.
Like, yeah. So reform is a jail cell with pretty wallpaper. We don't need mental health reform. We need total abolition of force and coercion. The system doesn't just have problems. It is the problem. So if we really fixed everything that's wrong with the mental health system, there would be no mental health system. This is an bold sentiment because this could be applied to the prison system. It could be applied to corporate capitalism.
Yeah.
If you want to fix the problems in it.
To reform it is to abolish it.
Yeah. And that's kind of the main argument for revolutionary kind of positions or radical positions is like, look, if you're not a radical, to me, it means you don't really want to solve the problem.
Yeah.
You want a fig leaf. You want the appearance, the status of solving a problem.
Yes, really the problem,
which is what's delivered.
The big problem that I see with the mental health system is that it exists not to help people live with whatever ails them, but is to fix them enough so that they are ready to return to work full time, mm-hmm. and resume selling their labor to the capitalists for wage labor.
That is always a priority in our society.
Yes, and I'm at the point in my treatment now where I am steady. I'm taking my meds. I'm keeping my daily routine fit so that I don't go off the rails and have a major depressive or manic episode. But because I've been doing so stable, people on my treatment team are now saying, "Oh, are you good enough to work now?" And it's been.
That's the purpose of life.
That's the purpose of life. And I said, I am not, you know, every time I've been employed, it results in a major depressive and eventually it'll make me ill again.
It's the cause of why I am like this.
Yes. And so, and I, you know.
And it's doing it to all of us. So.
Yes.
And so an idea that needs to be said more often is the idea that therapy individualizes and internalizes the societal problems, the psychoanalytics and all that, you know, what Jordan Peterson does, and all therapists kind of feel this, and maybe they'll talk about it with each other. Is, you know, I'm dealing with my, you know, it's, we're managing the workers to keep them just sane enough to go back to work,
just sane
and
enough.
It's kind of like, to use a literary example. the part in Harry Potter Part 6 where he has to, like, Dumbledore asks him to drink the water that makes him, like, convulse. And it's like, no matter what I say, keep giving me the water. And Harry has to lie to him, say, like, it's okay, this isn't the water. And it's like, over and over, just like, slowly killing Dumbledore, you know, and whatever. And it's obviously a very dramatic scene, you know. It makes you gives you those, has those, make you cringe and feel uncomfortable about what's happening. And that's the feeling we have at work. It's a feeling that, like, we have when we, if we ever, you know, these are uncomfortable feelings and we want to avoid them.
Yeah.
Because it means, like, oh, then I'd actually have to take bigger risks to get out of this, to lie, to say I'm not fit to work, that I'm not, I'm at the edge, so I can still work, but, you know, and then I see it in my, in coworkers, I see, you know, we all kind of see it ourselves, ourselves,
I think everybody and others sees around it, us,
and then we're all just ready to snap. We're just, like, not, maybe sometimes we're not dehumanized enough at work, and that's kind of like when you talk about having a good job. It's like the one that doesn't make you feel like total crap. You know, maybe there's some more parties. There's, or maybe you're just given enough autonomy that you aren't being driven to insanity.
Mm-hmm.
That you can manage yourself. You have control, and you can take breaks whenever you want. You know, you don't have to ask to go to the bathroom.
If work wasn't so long. If we didn't have, you know,
well, again, if you take more breaks, then you're not, like, you're only working.
If there was,
you're not
less,
working 8 hours.
If there was
working,
less pressure to perform, if there was,
yeah,
you know, I really do think that it is the capitalist system. What it requires of people and what it pushes people to do is just too much, and that's why we have a mental health crisis in this country with people getting depressed. People are overworked. They're underpaid. The prices of commodities are going up. The cost of labor is going down. People aren't getting enough money to pay for things. Once a physical health crisis hits and the doctor bills start coming in, that drives stress levels even higher. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand how, you know, normal people are able to deal with the stress. I certainly can't.
My observations are that, like, under the surface, they're like, they're not, like, it's just you numb yourself.
Yes.
With TV and drugs, or the comfort of whatever purpose that you have. Like, if you're a family part, you have kids.
Yes.
And that brings joy and purpose to your life that has nothing to do with work, and capitalism. But it's also then very isolating. It's like, then your family is just what matters.
Yeah. Everyone is
and everyone else is in the way.
Divided off into your own individual family. So,
we've really hit a lot of different varied topics.
All over the place today.
Yeah. But that's the way I kind of like to keep it. We'll see if people don't like that. But we got 6 segments to deal with. I kind of like to have one thing per segment. So the last story or topic we're going to cover is something that is not tied to current events, but is more geared towards what do we do to be better, to get away from all of this toxic stuff. And so as the left, you know, we care about egalitarianism. Would you say that?
Equality.
Yes. What inequality to us can mean, we'll argue for equality of outcome. Because, like, well, I mean, if you don't have basic resources, then what's the point? Especially since opportunity is dependent upon what resources you have. So this whole equality of opportunity thing is an equality of resources. And if we're not delivering that, then you're not really taking this poverty thing or this thing seriously.
Nope.
So this is from Films for Action. So Films for Action, they make some good videos. This is a story, or rather an essay, and it's titled "How Hunter-Gatherers Maintain Their Egalitarian Ways: 3 Complementary Theories." So this is from the realm of anthropology.
Yep.
And the study of man. to know ourselves and to know our how we operated in the past in a real way, and not just project how we operate in the past based on, you know, we have a competitive economy. That means we always compete with each other. We always have to compete with each other. And it's why the working class can't unite, because we're competing with each other. And that's tragic, because it means that, like, we're literally fighting between people on our block and not the people in the suburb or the far off cul-de-sac of millionaires. So this is I'll just hit the main kind of points and theories of this, that hunter-gatherers usually have across the world an egalitarian culture. So these are quote-unquote primitive people,
but they're not the violent savages.
I think more accurate to just say they're not industrial.
Yes.
Or they're not they don't have an urban center, but it's the village life. And it's always more communistic than not, and most certainly is egalitarian. So, like, how do they maintain these? And I think the general message is that it is not a passive process, just like how competition has to be almost forced most of the time. We have to, the kids need to be put into a game that's a competition. You know, it has to be a race organized by adults. Otherwise, what does the play look like? Running around in circles that doesn't really have any particular trophy at the end of it. There's no prize. Like, even game of tag, which, you know, who's the winner in a game of tag? Whoever it wasn't tagged. But you almost feel left out if you go the whole game and you weren't tagged, you weren't it.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't, like, the person who is engaging everyone else. You know, it's almost like you go off and hide by yourself. It's a very lonely place to be. You weren't tagged, so you won, but it was totally unsatisfying. So theory one is that hunter-gatherers practice a system of reverse dominance that prevented anyone from assuming power over others. So everyone needs to take an active role in making sure that the one person does not have more power than others, that there isn't a structure that allows for that. You know, we discussed the leader role. And how do you actually challenge that if everyone isn't talking with each other, if everyone doesn't take an active role in challenging the leader by saying, why are you the leader? Why don't we just do this together? If it's a particular project that you're the leader of, what are your qualifications? What makes you the best person to be, you know, managing this? Because if we leave it up to consent, you will have working groups that can be, you know, autocracies. It's like, yes, we give us your orders to build this house. So one practice is insulting the meat. Hunter comes back, maybe he gets a really good catch, and everyone says, oh, you know, it's too fatty. They insult the meat. Not the person, but just like, just kind of put him down a peg, you know.
So he doesn't brag about things.
Insulting culture, you know, like, you know, friends insulting each other is a way of maintaining the equality so that a clique is a group of equals.
Yes.
And so part of that is maintained by them, you know, I tearing them each other down, you know, it seems kind of toxic. It seems like it would be taken to a toxic level.
But not in this context.
But yeah, and then I think it depends on how, you know, it really matters.
Yeah, this
are you
this
are you
practice...
attacking the person, like, you look terrible, you, and then saying you always look terrible?
No, it's the game that you brought in.
Yeah.
And right. it's meant to keep people down a peg so that they don't start thinking that the meat they get is always great. Therefore, there's something great about meat.
Yeah.
It's an anti-individualist
system. And to put into, like, say, a high school clique, you know, oh, they have the better clothes. So we're going to say, oh, that doesn't match. It's your fashion sense. You got to change it.
Mm-hmm.
To make, you know, so that one friend isn't the best friend or the you know. Theory two is that hunter-gatherers maintain equality by nurturing the playful side of human nature. Play promotes equality. Let's see what kind of examples she gives. So it's social play. That is, play involving more than one player is necessarily egalitarian. It always requires a suspension of aggression and dominance with a heightened sensitivity to the needs and desires of the other players. Fairness. there's a desire for fairness within a game. So much so that you create whole systems of rules and books to kind of create a fairness, as in D&D,
yep,
table, any kind of board game. And if Monopoly seems unfair, it's just because the structure of capitalism is unfair.
That's why that game exists.
That's why it exists. To demonstrate that, it's surprising. People don't get that. Or maybe they do, but it's just you don't draw it to, oh, and this is what we're all operating in. Players, maybe the Monopoly man needs to be updated. He looks like Trump. Players may recognize, well, there is a Trump Monopoly, though, isn't there?
I don't know. They have a monopoly for everything.
Yeah, there's definitely a Trump one. Oh, there's definitely. Players may recognize that one playmate is better at the played activity than the others, but that recognition may not lead to one who is better to lord it over the others. This is true of play among animals as well as humans. For example, when two young monkeys of different size and strength engage in a play fight, the stronger one deliberately self-handicaps, avoids actions that would frighten or hurt the playmate, and sends repeated play signals that are understood as signs of non-aggression. We see this in play fighting all the time.
Yep.
Like, you see kids fighting, like, are they really fighting? Are they really, am I watching a gang up? And then, like, there'll be something about the noises made. If you just kind of look at it for more than a few seconds, they're like, oh, okay, they're just roughhousing.
Just rough. Yep.
What we
call see this
it.
In dogs too, you know?
Mm-hmm. And to keep, you know, and to see it all as conflict and separate the kids means, like, they're not playing, which means they're not learning to be social. And then you get your alt-right people. Because, I mean, that was kind of the toxic side of the protect the kids at any cost, helicopter parenting, protect kids from anything aggressive at all, even if it's playful. Even though, because it's not really aggressive. And the second it isn't, then it's not playing anymore, and someone gets hurt, someone's feelings get hurt. Theory 3 is hunter-gatherers maintain their ethos of equality through, this one's a little different, through child-rearing practices, which engendered feelings of trust and acceptance in each new generation.
Yeah, this was the most interesting part of the article, because it basically describes the children in hunter-gatherer societies as perfectly behaved, weren't throwing temper tantrums, weren't having crying fits,
mm-hmm.
and even in adolescence, when they start to, like, assert their own personalities, that parents didn't yell at them or anything, but would instead use very soft voices and be very subtle. And this would...
It gets down to the coercion inherent in our society, that children can't be allowed to be free,
to act as they would.
And be constricted, because we can't allow ourselves to be free. We have to restrict ourselves, or rather, we are restricted.
Yeah, you can't say what you feel at work. You'll get fired if you speak your mind about your actual conditions.
We cover that. So it's, oh, kids say the darnest things, which is like, it's bad that they speak their mind.
Yeah.
Or it's funny because we're not, they can do it and we can't.
Children are also very, very, very dialectical. In their thinking, they see contradictions in things.
They're very Socratic. They ask why.
They really want to know, and it's
and some parents get mad.
Yep,
because they can't ask. And right. If they ask why, it's scary, because then the livelihood is threatened.
Mm-hmm.
They would lose their job and whatever, and then what then? What do I want to get at? Oh, yeah. So to bring it, like, into a context that I understand, and we all might. So let's say we need to keep kids under wraps, tell them to be quiet. You know, they need to be well-behaved in restaurants or supermarkets or public places in general. Why all these restrictions? So basically, like, oh, you can't just pick up every product you want. You can't touch this or that. Why not?
Because you don't own it.
Yes. Because it's property, and because we have to buy, we have to get used to this. Things are there, but we can't have access to it without being wage slaves.
Yes, there's a lot of discipline that goes into making sure that new humans are turned away from their nature and become consumers and workers. that they accept this medium of exchange, money that just doesn't exist in these hunter-gatherer societies.
And the justification is, you know, I have to beat the children. I have to restrict the children.
There needs to be punishments.
Punishments. Because this is the way things are, and I have to prepare them for the quote-unquote real world, or rather the capitalist world.
Yes.
And it's like, well, since we're against these things, ethically, based on our own long-standing moral sensibilities from centuries and centuries, that beating kids is wrong. Which is also kind of recent as well. But as far as Western society, I'm not even going to call it that, our society, that then we have that revolutionary perspective. Like, yeah, we need to change how things work. I love the kind of, there's this book called Looking Forward. No, it wasn't Looking Forward. I forget the name, but I'll look it up again. But it was that kind of book from the late Victorian era, written by a socialist, where, like, because they would, it's a utopian book. Basically, the guy falls asleep and wakes up, and it's 2005, so it's far future, and everything's communist, and it's kind of projecting what it would be like. And there's all these, like, kind of camps set up by kids, and they're just kind of camping in the parks because that's what kids would want to do. And then he goes into a shop, and it's run by the kids. It's a smoke shop, and the kids are running it. And it's like, I'm surprised, like, this 10-year-old is managing the counter, and basically there's no paying, there's no money. It's like, what do I owe you? I'm like, you don't owe anything. We like making we got the pipes in, and we have the tobacco, and you want it, so you can take it. And he goes into chapters and chapters explaining how the economy actually works, and that, you know, you put in your bit of time at the workshop, and that entitles you to basically walk into a store and get whatever you want. And it's just a matter of limits of, like, okay, we're going to give you this much tobacco to fill your little pouch. And then she's like, oh, your pouch is so ragged. It's a terrible-looking pouch. Well, let me get you a new one. I'd like to probably cover that more in full. It was a very interesting read. And it's from that Victorian perspective, because the whole section of the book is just kind of like how it happened, how it occurred, because he goes to some old guy to kind of get the scoop on.
Yeah, how did we get from Victorian
capitalism to this utopian communism? It's like, oh, yeah, the 40s, there was a big revolution in the 40s, 1940s. And it's like, it was big, and he kind of goes through, like, the series of events. And very interesting stuff. Because it takes place in London. But it's a London that's, like, almost like the eco city, where you have these clusters of density, and then it's like farmland between everything. And it's great how everyone trusts each other. Like, this woman kind of asks him to hold her bag for a time, and then she comes back later. There's all these, like, little quick things. Okay, so I'm going to... Any parting thoughts?
Just based on what you said, like, you know, London and England going socialist before other areas of the world is just, that was total utopian thinking, and it's not the way that actually existing socialism has come about, where communist revolutions have been successful.
State has to be weak.
Yes, in places where the state is weak, usually after some large crisis like World War I, after that the Bolsheviks took power in Russia, and after World War II, eventually the Chinese... One,
it's why I'm not directly fighting the government now.
Yes, that's why I'm just organizing a group of essentially loosely affiliated social activists for reasons of supporting each other as comrades, rather than, you know, fighting ICE with guns.
It's the best
I'm about to advocate.
It's the best we can do, knowing that in the past, groups like the Black Panthers and all those other revolutionary groups
met with intense state repression.
Yeah, they were all jailed and then
killed.
And then there was no one doing the educating.
Mm-hmm.
And thus we had 30 years of people just, you know, it wasn't until I had to take a theory course in school before I read any Engels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm like, oh, so this is what socialism was really about. The conditions in Victorian England were just this bad, and Engels is like, something has to be done. Something has to be done.
Yes.
So, anyway, So with that, this is a Three Left Show. Check us out. We have Facebook page, Three Left Show on Facebook. On Patreon, just search Three Lefts. We can support us. And we'll be online. The website is threelefts.news. threelefts.news. And by the end of the week, there will be stuff there. Good. At the moment, there is nothing. But that will change.
We got to start somewhere.
And that started by actually going to a hacker friend of mine who has a company set up to actually help people like me, like us, do things online. That's great. So, solidarity, everybody.
Thank you.